Now, it's good to welcome back Brian Hughes, who, as I'm sure you know by now, is consultant solicitor of Shenfield-based Rayner Hughes. Now, the last time you were here, Brian, you tackled the subject of service charges paid by tenants who own leasehold properties. And you're keeping to the issue this week by looking at the nuts and bolts of service charges, are you not?
Yes, Scott. Last time I was looking at what these service charges are supposed to cover and what protection exists for tenants under the 1985 Landlord and Tenant Act. If you recall, I specifically made mention of the fact that landlords are not expected to make a profit, either directly or indirectly, out of service charges, and that they could not normally, for example, include in the service charges the cost of improving the building in which a flat or apartment is situate. The only profit a landlord is entitled to is the rent referred to in the tenant's lease. That said, however, if a landlord wanted to carry out repair and maintenance works to the building, whilst he was not obliged to accept the cheapest quote for the work, if any repair was going to cost more than £250 per tenant, or any service he was going to provide cost more than £100 per tenant, he would have to give each tenant notice. The tenants upon whom the notices were served would then be able to object and take the landlords to a property tribunal if necessary. If the landlord didn't serve the necessary notice, the tenant did not have to pay over and above the £250 or the £100. The landlord would have to pay the excess out of his own pocket.
Okay, so what are you specifically looking at today then?
Right. I want to explain what any tenant should expect to receive from a landlord or, in fact, a managing agent. First off, at the beginning of every service charge year, a landlord must provide his tenants with a budget, showing how much they will be expected to contribute towards the cost of maintaining the building and providing the services associated with the management of the building during the 12-month period. That's the next 12-month period. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. The budget must detail any forthcoming expenditure, and if it's going to cost more than £250 per head for maintenance or more than £100 for services, the likely cost must be specified in a formal notice. Not only that, but the likely cost must be established by the landlord obtaining three quotes from reputable contractors or providers of those services, so that each tenant can see that the cost of the proposed works or services has in fact been properly costed, and that the works or services are reasonable and necessary.
Is there a set date for the start date for the service charge year? Would this normally be the start of the financial year, for example?
The beginning of any service charge year often depends on the date of the first occupation of the building by the tenants. But there's no hard and fast rule. Some landlords run the service charge year from the 1st of January, others from the 1st of April, some from the end of September. The date is entirely up to the landlords. But whatever date is used, the important point is that a landlord must give a budget for 12 months and, if necessary, adjust the monthly amount paid by the tenants. This would normally mean a change in the standing order payment or direct debit taken out of the tenant's bank account. Unless the landlords or the managing agents have included a reserve in each annual budget, and there is enough in the reserve to cover any additional costs over and above the budget figure, then at the end of the year, there will usually be a shortfall, and that shortfall will have to be collected from the tenants who are in the building at the time.
So how is the shortfall calculated?
Detailed statements of actual expenditure, together with accounting policies and explanatory text, properly prepared by a properly qualified person, should be issued within 4 months of the end of the service charge year. In reality, service charge statements for residential tenants are often issued later than this, but the Landlord and Tenant Act 1985 provides that a residential tenant is not liable to pay service charge costs incurred if any of the relevant costs were incurred 18 months before a demand for payment was made or written notification received, which is a huge incentive for the landlords to prepare proper accounts as soon as the service charge year is over.
See that.
The other point about the demand or written notification is that it must be based on actual and not anticipated expenditure, apart from an annual contribution to a reserve fund. The costs which can be included in any service charge year's financial accounts are those in respect of which an invoice has been received or other demand for payment has been made. Tenants with long-term leases, that is to say in excess of 21 years, must additionally receive a summary of their rights and obligations with any demand for service charges that are submitted.
Now, you say that situations can arise where the amount spent by the landlord or their managing agent is more than the budget figure, is that right?
Well, indeed, yes. And if the tenant sells a flat during a service charge year, the landlord or managing agents cannot usually say by how much the actual expenditure during a year will exceed the budget figure. That means that the solicitors or conveyancers on each side of a transaction have to try and work out a retention from the sale price. If the service charge accounts have yet to be produced for the previous service charge year, the outgoing tenant might well be responsible for paying quite a lot more than the original budget figure for that year. Someone has to hold that amount, and it's usual for the seller, solicitor or conveyancer to agree to retain the estimated amount until the actual figure is known. That's why outgoing tenants often see a retention of several hundred pounds from the sale proceeds of their flat or apartment to cover what they may owe by way of outstanding service charges from the previous service charge year. In respect of a current service charge year, however, all the seller and purchaser can do is usually to apportion the budgeted figure, unless the managing agents or landlords can give an estimate of any likely excess for the 12-month period. Service charge accounts have to be audited, and tenants have a right to inspect them and to inspect all the invoices which make up the service charge total, so that you can see the landlords don't have it all their own way. There are substantial safeguards for the tenant. Points to note are that a tenant can apply to a property tribunal, called a first-tier tribunal, for a determination whether he or she is liable to pay service charges, and the request to the tribunal can be made before or after the tenant has paid them. The tribunal can determine who should pay the service charge if there is any dispute about who should pay it, which could be different. The amount could be different from the amount demanded. The date upon which it should be paid, for example, if it's a large amount, which a tenant cannot reasonably be expected to pay in one lump sum, and how it should be paid, for example, by monthly instalments. A tenant can also ask a tribunal to determine whether the landlord's legal charges for proceedings in connection with the service charges should be payable by the tenant.
Now, you mentioned just now that the service charge, that you hold some money back. What would happen if the amount due was actually more than the amount that you held back?
Well, that's the trick, isn't it? You've got to make sure that the amount that is retained covers any service charge liability.
Right.
And, of course, that's quite usual, and what most people don't realise solicitors and conveyancers have to do. They're sometimes quite irked when they see a retention from the sale proceeds, but then they should be informed that they owe something from the previous year,
right,
and it's got to be paid, and that's the only way of ensuring that it is paid.
And it can never be more than the retention.
Well, I'm not saying it never can be, but I don't think I've actually ever got to a situation where I've had to sort of put my hand in my pocket and subsidise a tenant.
Now look, Ryan, it seems to me that from what you said that this whole area is a minefield, and anyone who has a leasehold property needs to ensure that they're represented from the word go by a solicitor or conveyancer specialising in this area rather than the more general run-of-the-mill practitioner. Would that be fair?
Well, indeed, yes. As in all areas of the law, there are horses for courses. And if a solicitor is good at making wills for you, he probably won't have much of a clue when it comes to service charges. Having been around for over 50 years in the law, I've covered most areas, but I wouldn't hold myself out as an expert in any of them. Specialisation is now a requirement if you are to do any legal job properly.
Words of wisdom, methinks. So what subject do you plan to look at next time?
Leading on from what we've covered of late, I feel I should look at the next at the issues relating to buy-to-let properties and the assured short-hold tenancies that many tenants enter into with buy-to-let owners.
All right. Well, thanks very much indeed. Again, Brian, look forward to that.
Well, I look forward to seeing you next time.